So welcome everyone. Today's Life After Plane Masterclass is an interview with Dr. Gregory Sadler, author of Reason Fulfilled by Revelation. Dr. Sadler is also an executive coach, adjunct instructor of philosophy at Marist College, editor of Stoicism Today, and the president and founder of Reason.io. In this interview, we're going to look at how Stoic principles can be applied in everyday life to better face challenges like chronic pain and live well. So, welcome, Gregory. It's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm glad you guys invited me on.
So could we start off with a short background on Stoicism? Because in my understanding before I dug into this topic, and I think a lot of other people before they really learn a bit more about Stoicism, we just think of the English word to be stoical, which has a somewhat different meaning.
Yeah, so there's a first distinction to be made, which is between what you might call uppercase capital S Stoicism and then lowercase Stoicism. And there's Stoicism, the philosophy itself, which is the uppercase. And that's, you know, a pretty complex philosophical system that has a lot of principles and had a lot of followers back in ancient times and has been gathering a good bit of steam in the last 20 years or so. And then there's that word Stoic that we use generally to mean people who, you know, just stuff their emotions down or try not to have any emotions or stand up in the face of pain and don't really show anything. Or if they do, it's kind of a grimace, you know, to let you know that they're not going to let it get to them. And the two of them are connected, but they're not remotely the same. So I think the way that they got connected was there were a lot of people in the 1800s who had studied Stoic philosophy as part of their curriculum. And they would write, you know, using this adjective Stoic. And it was associated with a kind of manliness that went along with, you know, being rugged, standing up to adversity. And along the way, it gathered these connotations of either being totally unemotional or repressing the emotions, or just not show them, you know, not to take them into account. And then when it comes to pain, either not to feel pain or at least not to acknowledge it. And I think I mentioned as well that the two uses are connected. A lot of people in the 19th century wrote with that smaller lowercase Stoic as an adjective because they'd read some of the Stoics in school and they were familiar with their ideas, but they, you know, somewhat distorted them.
What I'd really love in this interview is to kind of get to the heart of Stoicism, because I mean, it's something I'm very interested and I'm fascinated with, and I think it would also be really useful for people who are facing a challenge like chronic pain. And there's a good reason why Stoic philosophy has become so much, well, has having a resurgence in the last 10, 20 years. So how does Stoic philosophy differ from the kind of common English understanding of Stoicism?
Well, so that's a long answer to that
question.
That's
a big question. Yeah.
But it's important. I'd say, you know, at the core of Stoic philosophy, there's different ways of framing this, and different key Stoic authors talked about it in slightly different ways. But one key idea is that, as they would put it, virtue is the only true good and vice is the only true bad. So that another way of looking at that is it's our character and our inner states and how we respond to things that's truly good or bad. And other things are, you know, if not completely indifferent, are certainly not of that scale. Epictetus talked a lot about freedom, and I think that's also at the core of Stoicism. Not a freedom in the sense of, like, just not being bothered by anything, but, you know, the freedom to determine for yourself what you wanted to make central, what you wanted to set aside. So I think a lot of people have been attracted to it because those ideas exercise kind of magnetic appeal over time. They're not the sort of thing that I think a person automatically gets in a moment and then says, aha, that's what I'm driving at. It's the sort of thing that grows on you over time. And I think a lot of people wind up getting into Stoicism, like today, and you know, the modern, you know, resurgence of Stoicism. It's because they read a blog post, or they listen to a podcast, or they you know, read an interview like this, and there's a few ideas in there that help make some sense out of whatever muddle their life is in, and you know, they start taking it on piecemeal. So maybe they encounter this notion of, you know, some things are in our control and other things aren't, and they start thinking things through, and that helps them out a bit. And then they're hungry for more because they see, well, this came from somewhere. And then some other people, you know, get into it through doing therapy, either cognitive behavior therapy or rational emotive behavior therapy, something in that spectrum. And then they start to dig into it, and they find out that the people who were formulating the theory had read Epictetus and drew on his works. So I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, the other thing, too, going back to that difference between, like, capital S Stoicism, the actual philosophy, and the lowercase thing. So genuine Stoic philosophy is not about repressing or getting rid of emotion in general. It's about finding ways to feel more positive emotions and try to gradually move away from some of the more negative ones, like anger, for example. The Stoics have a pretty dim view on anger, understandably so, or irrational fears. You know, they don't think that we shouldn't feel fear at all. If you're in a dark alley and somebody's coming at you with a knife, you should probably feel some fear. That's rational. But seeing a knife in a case and then thinking, I could be mugged with that, that would be an example of an irrational fear. Interestingly, when it came to pain itself, you know, thinking in terms of emotional pain, the Stoics didn't think that any of that was particularly good, but they did give us some useful ways to think about it or to approach it that can lessen its effects in our lives.
Okay. Well, I would love for us to look at some practical things, you know, that people can listen to this and then take away and apply into their life. So,
okay.
Because the thing with chronic pain is that there's a physical side of it, but often just as important as the emotional side, or the, again, anger, frustration, hopelessness, depression that comes along with it. And often people find that if they're able to manage the emotional side of things, then the physical side, the two, I mean, it's becoming neuroscientists are showing that the two are hugely linked in the brain, so that when you have emotional pain along with physical pain, you actually feel more physical pain as well. So if you can manage the emotional side of this, often it gives people the tools to also begin to do things to lessen the physical side. So
let's go
there.
Okay. Well, you know, I was just actually rereading an author who's not himself a Stoic, but who writes a lot about them. That's Cicero, and he was talking about exactly the sort of thing that you're referencing, that he was talking about the barbarians and the Greeks, and the fact that some of them can stand up to, you know, all sorts of pains on the battlefield, but, you know, they go home and they get sick, and suddenly they, you know, turn into these caricature of a sniveling little boy who's whining and all that sort of stuff. You know, and I think it's probably more associated with men than it is with women in our contemporary culture, that men are the wimps when it comes to chronic pain and illness and those sorts of things. And, you know, he recognized that there's a huge difference between feeling pain at one point in time, even terrible pain, like getting burned or something. And then just dealing with it day in, day out, you know, looking, you know, going to sleep and realizing that the next day that you wake up, you're probably going to feel just as much physical pain as you did the day before, that you're not going to be on the mend. That's very trying. So you're right. You know, there's a lot of emotional responses that come along with that. And, you know, over when it comes to chronic pain, these tend to become habitual. They become mindsets. And so they take quite a while to wean ourselves out of. You mentioned anger. I think that's a pretty common response to feeling chronic pain. And when we feel anger, it's because there's some sort of, not just, you know, an emotional response, but there's some sort of judgment, some sort of view on things that we can verbalize that we're making. And so, you know, this can happen sometimes through therapy or through, you know, introspection or having discussions with people. But it's usually something along the lines of, I don't deserve to have this pain. You know, this is wrong that I'm feeling this. And then, you know, you understandably look for somebody and something that can be blamed for it. This is what's most frustrating too about anger and chronic pain, in that, you know, if somebody cuts you off on the street as you're driving, you know who made you angry. It's that guy ahead of you in the car who's a jerk. And, you know, you shake your fist at him perhaps, or, you know, yell out the window or whatever. Mm. Perhaps you just stew, you know, turn up the radio really loud or something like that. But when it comes to chronic pain, you know, it's easy to feel this sense of being wronged and not knowing precisely who the blame should be put on, which makes it impossible to discharge the anger. And it's not a great idea to, you know, just discharge anger anyway. That oftentimes that can lead to problems. But you know, it becomes this ongoing kind of frustration that people feel. And so, you know, we say that people get moody or irritable, and we don't often take account of the fact that it's not just the pain, it's the feeling that I don't deserve this. Now stoicism can help out by going through and looking at the assumptions that people are making, that, you know, some sort of wrong was done to them by the way that their body happened to be. There might actually be some wrongs. Perhaps they were deprived of medical treatment that they should have received, or somebody, you know, here in the United States, we've got a huge problem with obesity and unhealthy lifestyles. And, you know, some of that can lead to chronic pain. Well, for instance, when people have neuropathic pain and diabetes. And you know, I think a Stoic can acknowledge that our culture doesn't give us the best messages about how we ought to eat. But ultimately, you know, a lot of that stems from our own choices, and we can get to the point where we realize that nobody really screwed us over. The universe didn't screw us over by having us feel pain. It's just a set of processes that have come out the way that they have, and we don't have to feel anger. You know, that is hard to tell yourself when you actually do feel angry, because anger is one of those self-reinforcing emotions. You know, tell an angry person, well, you don't have to be angry, and you're often liable to make them more angry, right? But over time, you know, you can keep telling yourself these sorts of things. I think, you know, it's useful when you've got other people that you're doing this with, like a support group or a therapist or a coach or a good, you know, good person just to chat with, a friend who's willing to listen to you for a while. But, so the Stoics, you know, when it came to anger, they were good at picking out why it's off base or why it's irrational. And so with time, you can change that. And it is with time. You know, Epictetus, in talking about anger, says if you manage to go, you know, a day without anger, put that on the calendar. Then, you know, if you go 3 days, put those on the calendar. If you make it 30 days, which is, you know, just extraordinary, then sacrifice, you know, to Zeus. And we might instead, I don't know, go out and have a, you know, a little dinner or something along those lines to celebrate. Because you've really accomplished something. It takes a while to change those habits. And then, you know, there's other emotions that I think are pretty common with chronic pain as well. And, you know, speaking both from my own experience, because I have some because of arthritis, and, you know, people that I've dealt with, one of them is fear, I think. You know, you dread getting up because, you know, things are going to hurt. Worries about, can you eat this sort of thing or not? Worries about how people will perceive you, you know, especially if you've been particularly athletic, you know, in the past, or, you know, robust. It can be difficult to address those. But again, we can look at those and think, is it rational for me to feel this amount of fear or to feel fear about this particular object? And then if we dig into it, sometimes we realize that perhaps we're valuing the wrong things, or we've got mistaken assumptions that we can then change, and then gradually change our emotions.
This is interesting. I'm wondering if we could dig a little more closely into the actual process. Say, if we look at the if you go a day without anger, and so how, you know, something happens, maybe you sit down and you feel your back, you know, stabbing your back, and then there's generally, if you were to kind of go into almost microseconds, you're going to feel the pain, and then there'll be a thought and an emotion that comes with that. What would a Stoic do in that process?
Okay. Well, Seneca will talk about what he calls pre-emotions, these sort of inchoate, heading towards something like anger responses that aren't quite yet the emotion. And then a thought process taking place, and then the actual emotion. And Seneca, you know, when it comes to anger, is a total pessimist. Once you're angry, forget it. You know, if it's full-blown anger, you just have to wait it out because there's no reasoning with you. But those earlier stages, when you know, part of it is cultivating awareness of your own reactions. And it's, you know, it's not just the Stoics who counsel this. You see this in yoga, and you see this in Buddhist training. Even some other Western philosophical traditions have done this as well. But you can see the red flag. You can say, oh, I'm starting to feel this thing, and I know where this heads. And then you can look at the thought process. And sometimes this takes a little while to get used to doing. And you can start to recognize where you are making assumptions. Like, okay, I've got this twinge of pain in my back. You know, it's that same damn thing that happened yesterday and the day before and the day before. So far, we're just at sort of factual statements. And then you can arrive at something like, I don't deserve to feel this. I've been, you know, deprived of something. Look at my friends. They don't have this sort of pain. You know, and we get on to something like, the universe is treating me poorly. And there, you know, you can, as you start to verbalize these, you can see, well, that's kind of irrational to say. And you can oppose it. You can generally, you can only oppose a thought with another thought. So the Stoics counseled having ready to hand things that they called dogmata, meaning, you know, short little statements. We get the word dogma from this, so something that you ought to believe. And they can be quite helpful, but it does take practice. And, you know, anger is a particularly interesting emotion with this, because if it doesn't come naturally, you know, and you're struggling with anger, it's also quite understandable to feel angry at the whole process. And why do I have to try this stupid thing, you know, that's not working?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is really common, you know, when you're trying to change your mindset and your habits, to fail a lot at first. It would be strange if we didn't. And you can remind yourself of that too. Again, I think this is really helpful when you have other people kind of reinforcing the message and saying, hey, you're not in it all by yourself. But it is something that you could do on your own. Yeah.
What are some of the dogmata?
Well, you can find a number of them in this short little book that is a sort of best hits of Epictetus called the Enchiridion or the Handbook. He'll tell you things like when you encounter something that appears disturbing to you, something that's presenting itself to you in a certain way, say to yourself, you're just an appearance and you're not necessarily the thing that you're telling me that you are. So it's both a statement and it's kind of a mental technique that you can do. So for example, you'll take the example of somebody cutting you off in traffic. You know, somebody cuts you off in traffic, it's pretty natural if you have a temper, like for instance I do, to assume that the person has chosen to cut you off and that they think that they're so much more valuable than you, or their time is more valuable or whatever, that they're entitled to do that. That may not, that may be totally the opposite. Maybe they're totally embarrassed of having done that to you, but you don't know, right? And so you allow your reasoning processes to be dragged along this line. Instead, you could say at the beginning, well, I don't know that that's the case. This is coming across this way, but I'm not sure that that's really the case. Now, you know, when it comes to physical pain, of course, it's not like you can tell yourself, well, I just think I'm having physical pain, but I'm not really having physical pain. That's nonsense. And the Stoic wouldn't tell you to do that for a second. Because I feel this physical pain, I won't be able to do the activity that I'd hoped to do today. Well, there's an assumption built in there. That may not actually be the case. So using your scenario, you're sitting in the chair and you feel this twinge of pain and you're like, oh, I wanted to go out to the park today and have a nice conversation with my friend. This is going to keep me from doing that. That line of reasoning, one doesn't have to go down. There's some choices that one can make to keep it from being automatic. And, maybe you give it a try and you do go to the park and you find that, no, the pain is too bad. And it turned out to be true. But you wouldn't know that unless you actually tried.
So it seems like in Stoicism, there's a process of questioning assumptions. And question them, you have to be awake to see the sort of inner ruminations of your mind and be awake to what's actually going on inside your head.
That's quite true, yeah. It does require what they call in Greek prosokhes, which we translate as attention, or another useful translation that I think is similar to what people do in other traditions is mindfulness, being mindful of what's going on with you, and it's one of those things too, where the more you do it, the better you get at it. You know, at first it's, you have people do sit down and try to be quiet and just attend to their own thoughts and feelings. You want to see some extreme reactions, have people, especially in like a type A environment. We did this one time, as part of a class at the Culinary Institute of America, where you have all these chefs, who are all essentially, type A personalities, used to working many long hours and yelling and all that sort of stuff. And just sitting quietly for 5 minutes, it was way too much for many of them. So, it is something that requires a bit of practice, but it pays off quite a lot as well. The other thing too is, when you start, when you're having chronic pain and it sometimes feels like the pain is just overwhelming you, it's all you can pay attention to. When you start paying attention to something else, like what your emotions are and what their sources are, what thoughts are going along with them, at least part of your mind is not taken up just with feeling the pain. And I mean, this also works for emotional pain too, I think. You have a terrible breakup and, everything looks terrible for quite some time. But then you start thinking, well, why am I so upset about this? what was it in that person that I'm going to miss and maybe never find in somebody else? And suddenly, it's not as if you don't feel bad at all, but you don't feel as bad. Now, again, that's the sort of thing you wouldn't necessarily have to be a Stoic to do that. But Stoicism does talk about those sort of situations and poverty and disease and social disgrace, all these sorts of things that we tend to be quite afraid of.
I'm interested because that was something that I remember reading, the idea that you every so often actually test drive or try out the things that you are most afraid of to see if they really are as bad as you had imagined. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Well, that's something that the Stoics would counsel doing, but it's not unique to them. Sometimes you do it in small amounts. And you can do it either by actually going into that situation, or you can do it by engaging in what's called negative visualization, or if you want a really nice fancy word for it, premeditatio malorum, the premeditation of the evils that you'll be enduring, right?
That is a fancy word.
Say that again?
That is a fancy word. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the, this is a total digression, but one of the benefits of having a classically oriented philosophy is you get a lot of interesting Greek and Latin words thrown in there. You can whip out. So to go back to the question, if you're looking at, actually going into a situation, one great example is people are, one of the greatest fears that people have is public speaking. I'm not exactly sure why, because I've never actually had that fear myself, so it's hard for me to relate to it. I think a lot of people who communicate for a living may not have had that issue, but apparently most people are quite afraid of it. So what do? You join Toastmasters, and they make you speak, but you only speak for a minute at first, and it's a rehearsed speech, and they gradually, wean you into it, and the whole goal is to get you to see that, it's not so bad as you thought, and that it's not so bad as you thought. Part of what's going on there is you're recognizing that your fears were, there's this affective side of it. It's what it's like to feel afraid and what it does to our body and all of those sorts of things. And then there's all these judgments that are built into it as well. If I speak, then people are going to look at me and think that I'm a fool because I won't communicate effectively. Well, that's a pretty sweeping judgment. Mm. There's a lot of assumptions built in there. That does happen every once in a while, I have to say. But it's pretty rare that does happen. And then with the, thinking about it beforehand, this is something that the Stoics made a practice of. They would say, think about what death is going to be like. I mean, that's very hard to picture. So think about what's going to happen when you die. Is it going to be as bad as we make it out to be? Or is it something that you're going to endure? And now, pick something much less dramatic. Think about this business meeting that you have to go into and make a presentation, and you're not really 100%, confident about the stuff that you're talking about, and you're the sort of person who really likes to have everything set up beforehand and feel entirely secure. What's the worst that could happen? You imagine it to yourself and then start thinking about, well, what resources would you have to deal with it? Do you have within yourself the capacity to think on your feet, to respond to people's questions intelligently? And if you do that sort of thing, it helps out quite a bit. Just empirically, it reduces people's anxiety, which probably has an effect of making it easier for them. But it also, over time, gets you used to this process so that, it may seem very artificial at first, but then with time, you can approach a situation and within a flash think, am I up to this? What are the challenges here? What's the worst that could happen? How would I deal with this? And then you just walk in and you're much more ready to deal with it. And with chronic pain, to go back to the key topic, you know, I think that one of the things that tends to get people down, understandably so, is the feeling like, well, it's never going to get better. I'm just going to feel worse and worse and worse. That's a fear that many people have. Because I have this pain, I won't be able to do something else that I really value. Like for example, I won't be able to be active as a father for my children and play with them in the park, you know, or be involved in their life in other meaningful ways. That's something people do fear, and it's something that you could over time think about. Well, how reasonable are these assumptions? Does the fact that I can't run in the park mean that I can't be involved with my kids' lives in any meaningful way? Well, that's not true, you know.
That's really interesting because, well, back to your earlier point about imagining the worst case scenario, because there's a high intersection between perfectionism and chronic pain. The two, just in the literature, it shows that people in chronic pain, a high proportion, have perfectionistic tendencies. And so, I mean, that in terms of thinking of, you know, is this going to be fatal? Will it be worse than death? No, it probably won't be. Is a really useful way for people who are perfectionistic to tamp down or reduce that those thought loops that can really drive up anxiety and drive up pain.
Oh yeah. Well, I think in terms of Stoic philosophy, probably the biggest thing that helps a person come to terms with perfectionism is that what they call the dichotomy of control, you know, that distinction between what is in our power fundamentally, or another way of translating it, what's our business, what is up to us, and then what's not in our power. And the Stoics think that when it comes to the things that are in our power, which are our thoughts and opinions, our feelings, our desires, our aversions, our choices, and, you know, to a certain degree, our actions aren't always, they're not always successful, you know, that we don't always attain what we intend, but it is more or less up to us. Those things are free, and we can make choices about them, and we can make those better or worse. There's this whole like ocean of stuff, you know, almost everything else in the universe that isn't up to us because it's up to something else, like you know, medical processes or somebody else's choices. And interestingly, the Stoics place the body in the class of the things that are not really up to us. And you might say, well, that sounds like nonsense because, you know, we know that if you eat well, you're probably going to have better health outcomes, or, you know, it's up to you whether you exercise or not. But, you know, it's not totally in your control. And I think one of the things that comes to awareness through chronic pain is how much that we think is really in our control doesn't turn out to be so. You know, if you take arthritis, for example, now you can take a pill for a while and it might mute the pain so that you're not actually registering it. Your body's still feeling it, of course, but you're not perceiving it. And that might work for a while, or it might not work for a while. You might get used to it, and then you need, you know, higher doses, and now you're dealing with some things that might be a little dicey, you know, sort of high caliber pain medication, which introduces all sorts of new issues of its own. Well, you know, when you're young and healthy, and running around and doing all sorts of stuff, it feels as if your body's totally in your control. as you age, as things start to wear out, as things like you know, for example, arthritis start to occur, then it becomes, you know, clear to you that you have only a certain amount of control, and that what you do still have control over, though, is how you respond to it. So this goes to what you were talking about. If you work at things in such a way that you can have a positive outlook and positive response, you probably won't feel as much pain, and you will be more active, and there's kind of a feedback loop there, at least with arthritis, right? You stay mobile and you feel less pain. If on the other hand, you decide, well, now my life is over, this is terrible, you're probably going to feel more pain, or at least the pain that you have, you're going to pay a lot closer attention to it.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the hardest things, I would say, in the human experience is simply recognizing, or how do you, as a Stoic, how do you sit with, okay, these things are beyond my control? What is the Stoic response to that huge ocean of things which are beyond your control?
Well, there's a couple different responses. One is to be accepting of the way things turn out. And you might say, well, you don't have a choice about that one way or the other, right? Things are the way they are, and you're stuck with them. But you do have a choice about whether you say all right to them, not even necessarily yes, but just okay, or whether you say, this is awful, you know, this should not be the case. I'm refusing. it's totally futile to refuse in that way to things that genuinely are out of our control. And that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, do some bargaining or something. You know, take, for example, another person's affection. That's not in your control. You can certainly make sure that they won't like you by doing certain things, right? But you can't make a person like you. They're not a robot with buttons inside that you can just push. And so, you know, if you realize you're at work and you have a personality conflict with somebody and, you know, they don't seem to like you, you can have a chat with them and find out, well, you know, am I off base in this? And they said, no, I genuinely don't like you. So why don't you like me? And then they, you know, they explain some things. It's, well, you're actually, you know, off base about this. I don't think this at all, or I don't do this thing that you don't like, and maybe they'll change. So there are some things that are outside of our control that could turn out better. But most of them are, you know, they're up to the rest of the universe, and we can go along with them. And if we do, we'll probably feel better. The other thing too is we can look very carefully at the things that we keep acting like are in our control that aren't in our control. And this is for, you know, for Stoics, this is really interesting stuff, because take anger again, right? So anger generally comes about because we feel somebody wronged us, and we feel like we can do something about it by making them feel bad in response, you know, imposing something on them. It's totally crazy because, you know, sure, we can sometimes make them feel lousy, but does that actually make us feel much better? Not really. And a lot of the times it doesn't work out anyway, you know. But you look at, like, you know, people who are describing themselves as Stoics on various communities, like, you know, Facebook groups. And they'll get into arguments with each other, get quite angry with each other. Now, if they're thinking it through, if they were practicing what it is that they're in the process of arguing with each other about, who's really a Stoic, what do the Stoics really teach, then they would say, it's not really good for me to get angry at all about this, or to get this angry. That's not really, all this stuff is not really something in my control. Whether I convince somebody else of, you know, what Stoicism is, or whether they should practice it, totally out of my control. You know, so I can certainly desire that somebody else would do these sorts of things. I see somebody who's hurting and I say, hey, this would help you out. And they say, you know, go away. I can feel, well, that's unfortunate. But if I make my happiness or my not being angry or something like that dependent on them, Epictetus actually goes on, he says, you basically, every time that you do something like that, you make yourself a slave to another person.
I'm interested because you said earlier that the Stoics don't think, feel free to correct me on this, but something along the lines of the Stoics don't think of things as good or bad, but they think in terms of virtues and vices, and only the things which are virtuous are good, and only the things which are vice have vice in them are bad. So,
yeah.
What are Stoic virtues? What do people who aspire to follow Stoicism, what are they aiming towards?
Well, they talked in terms of the four, what are called the cardinal virtues that Plato identified, namely practical wisdom, justice, temperance, and courage. But each of those included a lot of stuff. And so, you know, you might say, well, wait a second, what about telling the truth? You know, isn't honesty a virtue? Well, they put that under justice. Or what about, you know, being generous to other people? Well, that's part of justice too. And so those are the sort of like big headings, and then there's a lot of little subheadings under them. And then, you know, the vices would be the opposite of those. So cowardice, you know, the opposite of courage, injustice, you know, for example, being greedy would be a subtype of that, would be a vice of that. And the Stoics were, you know, they're very extreme about this. This is where not everybody who identifies as a Stoic necessarily goes along with the sort of uncompromising virtue is the only good, vice is the only bad, and you're either virtuous or vicious line that some of the classical Stoics went along with. I myself don't buy into that either. But they did tend to say things along those lines. And then, you know, the other flip side of it then is, well, what about everything else? For example, pain, what we're talking about here, physical pain. So the Stoics saw things like pleasure and pain as what they called indifference, things that were neither intrinsically good nor intrinsically bad. And, you know, if you just stopped there, then it would seem like, well, they don't care about anything outside of the scope of the person or the individual, you know, the personality. What they did, though, is they recognized that although pain and pleasure are not the good and the bad, we certainly do have desires and aversions about them that stem from our, like, the nature of our body. And they can get in the way of developing towards the virtues, or, you know, towards being free, or however else you want to put it. Or they can also steer us towards the things that can make us vicious. So, you know, when somebody's in chronic pain, it is more difficult for them to practice and develop the virtues. Understandably so. You know, if somebody's constantly having to battle against, say, not just feeling a pain in their back, but, you know, nausea and things like that, it makes things tougher. And the Stoics would be, any of the Stoics who, you know, grasp, you know, what human beings are like would admit that. I think there may be a few people who call themselves Stoics who don't do that, but they're not representative of the school. And likewise, you know, things like pleasure or wealth or health of the body, those things are not intrinsically good, but they are acknowledged as what they call preferred indifference, things that, you know, all things being equal, it'd be better to have than not to have, because they conduce to becoming virtuous. And, you know, there's no guarantee. It's not like if you pile up enough wealth, I mean, how many people have gone wrong this way? You pile up enough wealth, you're going to turn into a good person. You know, can certainly be used for bad. But, you know, it's easier to be generous when you actually have wealth than when you're poor, right? And it's easier to be kind to people when you're not feeling pain all the time.
Definitely. I mean, the idea that, because it's such an interesting ideal. As human beings, we're at a very basic level, we are programmed to avoid pain. So the idea that you could train yourself to be more or less indifferent to it, that is quite an extreme view. But it's interesting to put the actual virtue of an abstract principle higher than physical comfort.
Well, it's not just an abstract principle. It'd be something that's embodied in a person's character or personality. And it's something that could be shared in relationships like friendship, you know, with other people. But this is a place where I think the Stoics wound up being sort of at one end of the spectrum in comparison to the other philosophical schools. And there were some members of the school who said, yeah, we've got to back off on this sort of stuff. And sometimes they got themselves practically kicked out of the school for doing that. There were these these fellows that were called the Middle Stoics. We call them that because they weren't the early Stoics or the late, that is, Roman Stoics, but they were the guys in the middle who were teaching in other places. And they, you know, they were willing to say, you know, I think maybe virtue isn't the only good and vice isn't the only evil. They're certainly the best ones and the worst ones, but there's other stuff that we need to take into account. Cicero, who I mentioned before, is another great example of somebody who wasn't a Stoic himself, but was very receptive to their ideas. But when it came to pain, he talks about this in a book that he calls the Tusculan Disputations. He's got a whole part of it devoted to pain, and he says, I think the Stoics are wrong about this. They want to say that pain doesn't matter at all. I want to say that pain does matter. It's just not the primary bad thing. There's other things that are worse than it, like, you know, disgracing your country or, you know, making yourself into a bad person. But it is still a bad thing. So I think in modern Stoicism, there is room for some disagreement about this. And the other thing that I'll say about this too, is that it's possible to adopt, partial perspectives and techniques or strategies from the Stoics without going all in and saying that the ancient Stoics were entirely right about everything.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think even to start to look at adopting some of the daily practices. What are some other daily Stoic practices that you think would be particularly helpful?
Well, you know, Marcus Aurelius, he was a Roman emperor, so he had to deal with a lot of nonsense in his work, you know, and a lot of temptations too, you know. He would begin each day, he writes this in his meditations, he'd say, this is how you should begin each day. Say to yourself that I'm going to run into a whole bunch of people who are going to be, this is very, very roughly paraphrasing, real pains in the rear for this reason or this reason or this reason. And it's up to me how I want to respond to them. I can choose to get angry with them or hate them or whatever, or I can realize that as a rational being, I share a common nature with them. And whatever nonsense they're bringing to the table, I don't have to get you know, caught up in that. And I can treat them as my fellow human beings. That's up to me. And I think having a reminder like that in the morning is particularly helpful. As a matter of fact, this might be something good to remember going into any committee meeting or, you know, those sorts of things, you know, or dealing with the client that, you know, is going to be difficult or something along those lines. But, you know, making that part of one's routine gradually changes one's mindset. being able to stop and pause for a second and think about, well, what you know, what's presenting itself to me and what assumptions am I making about it is also very helpful as well. And the Stoics ended, well, at least the, you know, the ones who were very serious about it, they ended with something kind of similar to the Christian you know, examination of conscience at night, where they would, you know, as they're going to sleep, they think about the day that they've gone through and what went well, where, you know, where things needed more work. Maybe they weren't up to the challenges and they responded badly. And then they would, you know, think about the next day and how they can do things better, and also forgive themselves for whatever failings they had during the day. And that's a very, you know, when you've got this kind of routine, that helps out quite a lot as well. But this isn't something unique, again, to the Stoics. You see this in a lot of traditions of that are oriented towards becoming more mindful and gradually retraining one's habits and attitudes.
Yeah, I find this very interesting. I've been interested in habits and how they work and how to, you know, gradually live more deliberately for some time.
Yeah.
And I think the Stoicism, it seems to me like a very reasoned, very practical, but very sort of down-to-earth and pragmatic way to approach things, where you look at what is, not rather than what should be, and then decide what you're going to do about it from there.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of what should be. Ideally, we'd all be like totally rational all the time, and that would extend to also being social creatures, and so we'd never make each other angry or afraid or those sorts of things. But you know, there's like the really live discussion about did a Stoic, you know, ideal of the wise person, the sage, ever exist or not? You know, and the answer to a lot of that is, worry about that when you become a sage or when you get close to it. You know, for now, your life is messed up enough that you probably have plenty of stuff to work on.
Yeah,
so, yeah, you're
practical.
Right. The other thing is, too, it's, you know, Stoics are not evangelists. So they don't say, well, everybody needs to become a Stoic, you know. They, you know, they are content to teach it. And then if somebody found it useful by actually applying it, well, then that's great. And, you know, then they'll go on and maybe influence a few other people. But they weren't out there, you know, on the street corners saying, you need to, you know, buy the Meditations and read it, or the handbook. You're not going to find, you know, the Stoic equivalent of the Gideon Bible in hotel rooms. Although that wouldn't be a bad idea, you know?
No, yeah. I mean, it seems to me that they weren't, and again, correct me if you think I'm off track here, but they weren't so much interested in making the world an easier place to live in, but more in making sure that they had the resources to deal with the inevitable difficulties as they came up.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I would say that, on the whole, that's right, that they were not trying to make the world different than it is. And part of the nature of that world is that it's full of people who are not Stoics, or even, you know, some of the ones who are Stoics are, you know, doing things for all sorts of mixed up reasons and getting in each other's way and causing each other quite a bit of suffering. I would say that for the Stoics, the bit of the world that you are involved in, which would include like the matrix of your own relationships and roles, you know, like your family and friends, and even to some degree your country, they would concentrate on what they could do to make that better, you know, less irrational, less unfair. But they would understand that every time that you're engaging in action that goes out into the world, you know, you control the input, you control what your part is, but you really don't control what happens with it once you've let it go out into the world. And so, you can do great things and people can totally misinterpret them and say you're a terrible person for doing them or even thinking that, anybody needs that sort of help. Now dealing with children is a great example of this. You know, when you have kids, sometimes they're profoundly grateful for the things that you do for them, that you ought to do for them. And sometimes they think you're, the worst person in the world for doing those sorts of things, right? But you know, and this is where like stoicism has something to say to the parents, you don't make the kids and their responses to you as immature emotional beings, the criterion for whether you're doing the right thing for them. you rationally think it out. But, the other thing is, and this is a big topic of discussion in contemporary stoicism is, if you're a Stoic, does that give you a right to behave as if everyone else is or ought to be Stoics? And the answer is no. So if you know that, Stoic can say, I'm not insulted by what the person is saying unless I choose to be insulted by what the person is saying to me. But that doesn't mean that if I say something that another person takes as insulting, that I haven't insulted them. Even though they have a choice about how they want to take it. If I know that, for example, if I know that my kid doesn't like having something pointed out that because of being an adolescent they're sensitive about, and I make some remark about it, that's up to me. It's kind of imprudent on my part to pick at something that or to do it in that way that is going to provoke that response. And I don't control their response, but I can still say, well, I don't need to do that, unless perhaps it's something where I absolutely have to confront them on it. Like let's say a kid is not ever taking showers, you need to bring that up. Right?
Yeah.
But so, the point is that you don't have control over the world, but you do have control over how you interact with the world, what you do with, the bit of freedom that you have and the resources that you have.
Well, we're coming to the top of the hour. I just have sort of one sort of summing up question though for you. Would it be fair to say that somebody who follows Stoic philosophy would achieve a kind of not insulation, but I guess resilience or equanimity in the face of the inevitable ups and downs and tumult of life. As they go along, they are maybe better able to keep on an even keel despite all the things that try to knock us off course as human beings living in the world.
I'd say that's entirely right. And I like that distinction between insulation and resilience because, insulation makes it sound like you've got this kind of hard outer shell and then you're, soft, vulnerable insides and you keep the world from getting to you. And that's, I think, the lowercase stoicism that we talked about at the beginning. Don't let anyone see your feelings. The notion of being able to exist fully as who you are in the world, as messed up as it is, and the world not being able to throw you off kilter in a permanent way, being able to respond to it, and perhaps even make part of it better, that's resiliency, what you're talking about there. And yeah, that's Stoic ideal.
Fantastic. Okay, well,
you don't measure up to them. So, it's a continual process of getting up. Yeah, good.
Sorry, I just cut out a little bit there. You were saying it, the Stoic ideal is something that you may or may not measure up to, but...
Oh, so yeah, it's a continual process. Epictetus, I keep bringing him up because he's the person I look at the most, likes a lot of metaphors of wrestling. You get knocked down, well, get back up and get back into the wrestling match.
Well, Professor, sorry, Dr. Sadler, thank you so much anyone listening, I'm going to put underneath this interview links to reason.io, Stoicism Today, and also Gregory's YouTube channel, which has a huge amount of wealth of fantastic videos on Stoicism and also on other philosophy, where I think you're wonderful in that you break things down and make them very accessible. I definitely recommend people check that out.
Well, thanks.
And thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge and, you know, help people who want to live and use Stoic concepts to live better and face the challenges of chronic pain.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation.